Everyone, it's Kirsten. Welcome to season 3 of The Anthropocene.
The scene is set. You have been asleep a while. It is still cool outside, but it's definitely warmer now. You toss and you turn until you just can't sleep anymore. You slowly wake up completely and you are absolutely starving. You stretch, yawn, and crawl out of your bed. The light is way too bright, but it's a beautiful day. However, the only thing you can think about is food. Groggily, you look for something to eat until you smell something intriguing. Walking and walking, soon the trees thin and turn into fences and houses. Everything smells strange and there are weird noises around you, but the promise of food keeps you moving forward. Your nose leads you to a large metal box, and lucky for you, the lid is wide open. You scramble inside and find food scraps that you begin to eat hungrily. However, you are soon startled from your feast from a bunch of loud noises, banging on the side of the metal and shouting. Frightened and confused, you leap from the bin and run back to the woods. You are shaken up, but you're quickly distracted by a patch of tasty rosebuds. This is a much better meal anyways, and no one disturbs you while you feast away, gaining back those precious calories you lost this winter. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of season 3. Today, I am super excited because I have a guest on that I've been following for a long time on Instagram, and we've, you know, chatted through comments, but we've never actually got to talk. So that's super fun. And I have, who you definitely need to follow, check out the link in the show notes, Taho Tuji, as most people know him by. So this is a local bear expert for coexistence between people and black bears. So we're going to be talking all about the Taho urbanized bears. Get cozy in your little dens and let's get started. Tuji, thank you so much. Could you please introduce yourself to the people?
Well, thanks so much for having me here today. My name is Tuji Silchin. My background is I'm a 41-year resident of South Lake Tahoe. I moved here in the early 80s. I actually grew up on Maui in Hawaii, but came here as a young man and wanted to be a ski bum. And almost for the first 20 years of living here in the Lake Tahoe Basin, you only heard about people seeing a bear once every 1 or 2 years, really. But in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, a new phenomenon was starting to happen. What that is the urbanization of black bears. And this is happening to a lot of other wildlife species as well. And it's not just happening here in South Lake Tahoe. This urbanization of black bears and other species of wildlife is also happening in places like Gatlinburg, Tennessee, Asheville, North Carolina, Durango, Colorado, Aspen, Colorado, Mammoth, California. Anywhere where you would have an urban environment that interfaces with a wild environment with a local population of black bears, it seems over the last 20 years they've become, you know, we use the term urbanized, they've become highly urbanized because they've completely changed a lot of their behaviors and even some of their physiological activities through this. And it's a long story and we'll talk more about it as we go. But so 20 years ago, I saw a bear out camping, and I did something to move it out of the campground, and it all worked. I was like, wow, that was really interesting, and I just became so enamored with this animal, and nobody seemed to know that much about it. You heard all the same stuff, but I really wanted to take the deep dive, so I just started anecdotally, really, observation, because I'm not a wildlife biologist. I do field biology work, but that has to do with my job, but I'm not a biologist. Okay. And I like to point that out to people because some people mistake me, you know, are you a biologist? And sometimes my answer is no, but I often play one on TV. So, but really, I've just become so enamored with it. And then along with my job, which is working outdoors in the field, it really dovetailed really nicely. And I just, one time I got a bear out from under somebody's house. Somebody asked me to get out. Never done it before, and I did it. Once I'd done that, people heard about it. It kind of snowballed, and that was over 10 years ago. So right. I've kind of become one of the main, you know, bear eviction aversion guys here in the South Shore of Lake Tahoe, and we'll talk more about that as well.
Okay, that's super interesting. Yeah, it comes up again and again on this podcast how people kind of like accidentally sort of fall into what they're doing because of a passion or an interest, and you never really know where you're gonna end up. I feel like that should be like the slogan now from the last few episodes that we've had. Before we really do, like, circle back and dive into the bears then, when you introduced yourself to me, you said you are a vector technician. Could you just tell us, like, a little bit about that? Because I think that's super interesting as well.
Sure. Well, I'm senior vector technician for the County of El Dorado here in the state of California. I only work 7 months a year, so actually right now I'm off. I go back to work in about 2.5 weeks to start our season back up. Generally speaking, being a vector technician, we focus on mosquito abatement, yellow jacket abatement. But here in the High Sierra, as a vector tech, we also have another focus because I have more boots on the ground experience than any other vector tech in the state of California in one of the longest plague studies in the history of the state of California. So I'm really well versed in the surveillance of plague that moving through sylvatic species of rodents, the plague transmission cycle from sylvatic species of rodents to humans. And I've done work to mitigate that. We've done treatments to mitigate the transmission when we come up with positive fleas, with positive Yersinia pestis, which is the causative agent of plague. So again, I do a great deal of field biology. I work often hand in hand, and I do that with the states, but I work with them also on their vector-borne disease case studies. So a patient gets a vector-borne disease here in the south shore of Lake Tahoe, and the state does an investigation. They bring me in with them, and I run right there with them because, again, it's boots on the ground experience and a knowledge of the local geography and the species that move through the area. So I do a lot of biology work. I have a great understanding of the biological process. And throughout my experience, I've kind of learned to speak some of the language as well. So I love my job. I have a passion for it like you wouldn't even believe.
Wow, that sounds so interesting. I know it was crazy to me. I think I was reading like the Science Today newsletter about somebody getting the plague in Ohio. And I hadn't even, like, this seems really ignorant, but I hadn't even realized that the plague was still like an active issue. Like, it's such this like abstract, a million years ago problem, which I know not even that long, but and they probably got it from their cat, which if you didn't have enough reasons to keep your cat indoors, here's another one, people. But anyway, digress for now. But yeah, that was crazy to me. I couldn't believe it.
No, that's true. Interestingly enough, in 2020, we had a local human plague case, non-fatal, that I was deeply involved in that investigation, and we figured out exactly where she got it from. Mm-hmm. So here, our host species of Yersinia pestis, of the plague causative agent, would be our sylvatic rodents. In other words, California ground squirrel, golden mantle squirrel, and our 5-6 species of chipmunks we have here.
Right,
okay. So whereas in other places like in Ohio and Colorado, it runs through the prairie dog population. Mm. But the deal about you brought the cats with the woman in Ohio. So if I get bit by a flea that's carrying Yersinia pestis and it transmits that to me, I'm contracting what's called bubonic plague. It goes into my blood and goes into my lymph nodes, bubos, under your shoulders. You'll have swelling in your neck and your crotch and under your shoulders, under your armpits there. And you have about almost 2 weeks to treat it. It's pretty safe. But what happens when you get it from a cat is a cat's got it from that flea bite, but now the cat can spread it pneumatically.
Right.
So it's coughing up its sputum. And when you contract it that way directly into your lungs, you've got about 3 days for treating that disease. And it's highly treatable with antibiotics because it's not a virus, it's a bacteria. So, yeah, but it happens. And there was just a case recently of a cat testing positive for plague up in North Lake Tahoe, actually in Truckee, I believe.
Okay.
So, yeah. Vector-borne diseases are really interesting.
Right, the plague. The plague
and I could take it down a hole. I could take it down a deep rabbit hole and all that stuff because I'm highly trained on it. But we're not here to talk about that today,
right?
Are we?
I mean, we could come back another time maybe, and we could get into that as well. But yeah, I just wanted to introduce that for a little bit of your background. But yeah, I mean, people are probably here for the bears because we love the bears, so we're going to get back into that. So you told me a little.
Interestingly enough, I sorry to interrupt you, but oftentimes I've collected bears that have been hit by cars. Mm-hmm. And I pick them up and then I discard them for fish and wildlife into a safe place and dispose of them or lay them to rest is a better way to put it, really. But I always take blood swabs and I submit those to the state for plague testing also because we like to see how plague moves through other wild animals, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a mammalian disease, so it can run through other mammals.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had an actual bear test positive once that was hit and killed by a car. So just a side note that the two can be kind of be combined.
Oh, absolutely. There's so many intersections across literally everything, like in all the different studies and the ranges of biology. So yeah. And I mean, like you said, you were spending a lot of time outdoors in your job. And then, yeah, you little by little just became, I guess maybe obsessed isn't the right word with the bears, but what is a little bit more of that background story, how you became like this local go-to guy?
Well, like I said, I started learning more and more about their behavior, but the more I learned, the more I wanted to know. Mm-hmm. Where do they sleep? You know, because I always hear, well, I have a bear that lives behind my house in the woods. And, you know, they don't live in one place at certain times of year, and we can talk more about that. But I just became, it seemed to me that there wasn't that much knowledge about them, because even though you see them around, they can be very cryptic.
Right.
At the same time, they're not that easy to study because they're always on the move. Mm-hmm. They don't live in one place. They're always moving about, you know, during the spring, fall, and summer when they're not denning over winter. So, and through this workout program I have where I get up really early in the morning and walk through a neighborhood, and I did this big 7-mile loop walk, and I'd go through this one neighborhood that all these apartment complexes with dumpsters that often got left open. And I was able to use that as a teaching tool to teach myself aversion techniques with bears. So my gig was I'd go through those places and get the bears off the dumpsters. I'd run them off the dumpsters mm-hmm. with nothing but my attitude.
Right.
And then once I went under a house and did that, it snowballed. And then, you know, people started calling me. So I'm in the presence of bears close to 150 times a year. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, doing aversions, evictions, I do average about 30 to 40 of those a year. But I go check on bears. I know where they bed down in the summer. I know where they're denning in the winter. And I go look at them. I like to study them. In the wintertime, I'll crawl onto dens with males and put cameras on them to see how they're reacting and what happens. And it's always interesting because, you know, people have a different idea of what hibernation is compared mm-hmm. to what it actually is. Mm-hmm. It's very different. Torpor is not in a coma-like state. They're actually very cognitive, they're awake, and when I'm under the house with them in those situations, they're looking at me and watching me, and I really have to pay attention to them to make sure that they don't get stressed out in that situation. If I'm moving a bear, then I'm stressing it.
Right.
That's the goal. But mm-hmm. if I'm just observing a bear, say, I speak to them very calmly and comfortably, it's a whole different demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand their behaviors, and it's just my study of that. And through, I won't lie, there's been some trial and error. I've had some situations where I'm like, whoa, shouldn't have done that one. That was mm-hmm. a tight situation. But you learn from those experiences. I've done over close to 300 evictions, aversions. I mean, and I've been under houses with bears in another 100 plus times. So
right.
That's just a build up of experience and that behavior. And that was really helpful when I worked on that National Geographic article with my friend Corey Arnold, the photographer, mm-hmm. that one of the pictures we captured together won every wildlife photography award in early 2023 that was published in 2022. And that article was published. It was all about urbanized wildlife. It wasn't just about bears. It was also about coyotes and raccoons.
Yeah.
Because those three species have three things in common that make them do actually really well, and they can thrive when humans encroach. Mm-hmm. And why that is because they're all three highly intelligent.
Yeah.
They're all three opportunistic feeders that can eat a broad variety of food sources, and all three of them are highly adaptable to new situations and learning and taking that knowledge and changing their behavior because of it.
Right.
It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, we have all these places that, you know, little by little towns are just encroaching more and more on the forest. So like the only option for survival for a lot of them, or maybe not the only option, but a very good option for them, is to just adapt to what's coming instead of move along, because there's only so much space left. So this is what we're ending up with as we keep expanding into these natural areas. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that's very true. But what's also happening, what we're seeing with this urbanized black bear population, again, not just here, Great Smoky Mountains has the same situation mm-hmm. going on as well, is They're thriving so much that their population densities are getting extremely high and unnatural.
Right.
In other words, here in the Lake Tahoe Basin, it's the estimate of our black bear population currently, and it's just an estimate, runs about 400 to 500 bears within the Lake Tahoe Basin. And we're talking about, what, about 190,000 acres of land. Let me put that into perspective. Yosemite has 750,000 acres of land, and everybody thinks Yosemite National Park. Bears everywhere there. Yosemite has an estimated black bear population of 500. That means in Yosemite, there's one bear for every 2.3 square miles. Here in the Lake Tahoe Basin, and specifically on the south shore of Lake Tahoe, we're averaging 2 to 3 bears per square mile.
Wow.
And they're changing their behaviors because they don't have to fight for territory anymore. These urbanized black bears are willing to live in harmony with each other, which they would never do in a wildland environment. Three different times in three different winters, I've documented two very large unrelated males, and these are different sets of males, denning with feet from each other under the same building.
Right.
That's incredible. That would never happen in a wild environment. But here in this urbanized urban environment, there's no competition for food sources and there's no competition for mates because there's enough of both moving around. I've even documented three males of different ages, black bears. They'll go, well, maybe they're siblings. Well, if they're siblings of different litters, they would never know each other. Right. There's no way. There's no connectivity between the family like that. That's completely unheard of, to have males moving through the environment together as a group.
Right.
Generally, the only time black bears socialize with other adult black bears is during mating season. And even that's kind of iffy. And females mate with a number of different male bears. They don't hang out with one. So this urbanization situation is changing their behavior. So people are, you know, some people have said, well, are you an expert on black bears? No, I'm not an expert on black bears. I believe my expertise is in the urbanization of black bears, because that's what I live, boots on the ground with every single day of the year here in Lake Tahoe. I mean, Lake Tahoe, we've become the poster child for urbanized black bear situation and the human bear conflict issues that come with that.
Right. Well, I think this speaks so much to the importance of, like, natural history, which is this, you know, observation, which I think so many people now that are whatever trained quote unquote wildlife biologists, like, all the work they're doing is just as important as that, but there's not always the time or the funding just to observe and just to put more camera traps and, like, you know, the things that you're saying that you're doing in your day-to-day life. And I think it's like a piece that's like really missing from the science is this natural history element, which is just observation. And I mean, some people debate it, whether it's science or not, but it adds to science, absolutely. And it's so crucial to understand what's going on.
It really is. And I do get a chance to work with a lot of our wildlife biologists specializing in black bear biology from both the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Nevada Department of Wildlife, where I worked with all those main biologists in the field on active bear situations. And I'm lucky because they treat me with a fair amount of respect. So I provide them with a lot of different things. There's many times I go out and collect DNA samples for them. They've trained me how to collect that. It's not that hard. And, you know, doing saliva swabs or collecting hair samples, it's pretty simple. I provide them with a lot of information and data through that. Just through my observations, I see something weird and I have a video of it. I share it with them. Sometimes they create educational content and they'll ask me to provide them with content to put into their content because it shows some of the behaviors that they're looking for. Yeah, everyone sees the pictures of the tourists at the beach getting the video of a mom and three bears going swimming out at Lake Tahoe. But it's the kind of behind the scenes stuff, and that's kind of what my cameras out in the field do. And I'm also observing other wildlife as well.
Yeah.
So and when I see something that's out of the ordinary, the first thing I do is get a hold of my biologist friends and go, whoa, this is what I got going on. Check this out. And they're like, whoa. You know, they get interest. I mean, what was it, in 2021, I captured a video of a badger and a coyote moving through the environment together. It's called mutualism. It's actually a thing. My friend Emma's doing her whole master's thesis on it. So it's exciting to be able to contribute to that, right? There has to be this connectivity between the community members, you know, especially when we're talking about wildlife management folks. So There has to be some kind of connectivity between the wildlife biologists, they're tasked with managing a species that moves through our human environment, and the community members. We got to work together to mitigate the human-bear conflict issues.
Absolutely.
It doesn't work if we, because there's some people that like to create adversarial relationships with fish and wildlife from either Nevada or California. I do everything I can to work with them. Do I agree with everything they do all the time? No, I don't. Sometimes I wish they'd do a little more. Sometimes I wish they'd do a little less. But at least they often listen to me and they take my opinion.
Right.
And listen to it. Doesn't mean they're going to do what I say, but they're willing to talk to a community member that they know has a pretty deep understanding of what they're doing.
Yeah, well, it's so important.
That whole citizen science thing, right?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And I mean, why then would you be putting all the work in to like work with coexistence with bears in the community if you're not even interacting or talking with the community? Like, they're the main stakeholders that are involved, and they need to be involved at all the stages. I think that's something that has come up a couple times just chatting with people that are doing work, that, you know, you can't just come in and like kind of do an interview at the beginning and then, okay, like, here's what we came up with at the end, and maybe hand out like a shitty pamphlet, and that's like that's all you've done to do the work. But yeah, it's super good to hear then that there is this collaboration and that you're working together. It's refreshing for sure.
It's very important too. Mm-hmm. because urbanized black bears, this is black bears walking through your environment. And again, black bears are not generally a dangerous species to be around. As long as you give them their space, don't block them in, you know. But I like to remind people, if they ever see any of the videos of me doing an eviction, don't try that at home. It's something you don't want to do.
Yeah.
And I go into those situations with planning. Mm-hmm. You know, I have that little Rolodex in my head. So because every situation is different. Every crawl space is different. I don't go under every house with bears to get them out. If I find an easier way, then I take the easiest route, the safest route.
Right.
But the other consideration that people don't really see when they see a video of me evicting a bear is what the bear does afterwards. And that's very important to me, because if I'm evicting a bear from under a property and it's right next to a very busy highway, I have to be completely positive that I'm going to make sure that bear doesn't run out that way, because it's a wild animal. It's going to go where it wants to go.
Yeah.
So sometimes you have to figure things out and you have to block certain things, but we always have those plans. When we go, when my teammate Leona and I, we do an eviction, we look at the situation and we have our little safety meeting is what we call it. You know, it's just a minute or two. And we set our plans, because we have plan A, plan B, and then there's what we call the uh-oh plan, right?
Okay,
things really go sideways. We still have to deal with the situation. And in all the evictions I've done, I've never been unsuccessful. So someone's asked me to get a bear from their house, I've gotten it out, and I've never harmed a bear or a human doing those evictions. I've had a few fences broken by bears, but
yeah.
You know, I look at the homeowner, I'm sorry, that's a bear.
Right. Necessary casualties, I guess. Just the fence.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the question, some people might ask the question, well, why do you have to get them out front of the house? Some people get really upset at me that we do that. They think, well, you're taking away their denning space. Well, first, I like to remind the people that here in the Lake Tahoe Basin, we're surrounded by green zones. I mean, completely surrounded by a forest. And here in South Lake Tahoe, our neighborhoods are like little islands surrounded by green zones. So there is a plethora of natural denning sites throughout the whole Lake Tahoe Basin. But our urbanized black bears become very comfortable, and it's a behavior they've learned. They're probably born under a house. And so generally when I kick them up under a house, they just go find another one to get under, because they usually have 2 to 3. And so I get the people, well, why don't you just leave them there? Well, that's an excellent question. And I'm going to give you an excellent answer. There's infrastructure under houses. There can be heat ducting. There can be plumbing. There can be water pipes. There can be wiring. And when you put a 300 to 400 pound body moving through 16 to 18 inch crawl space with some of that stuff, they can do a lot of damage. And they're not doing the damage maliciously, although when they see heat ducting, they know what it is. They rip it open and they put their bed right in front of it.
Wow.
Right? And that heat just blows on them all the time. Because once they've done that, it's not going up in the house.
Yeah.
So they're, like I said, extremely intelligent animals. And once they figure that one out, they know what it looks like and they do it. So I had one house, some folks, I was getting this bear out. It was ripping through the siding of their wall under the deck to get into the crawl space to bed. And it had done upwards of $10,000+ of damage under there.
Wow.
And again, electrical wiring. What if they rip a wire? And they'll pull all the insulation down for bedding.
Right.
If there's floor insulation there. So it's just not an ideal situation. In a perfect world, they'd go find a place out in the wild. And really, we're just trying. When I do those evictions, we call it tough love.
Right.
I'm not hurting those bears. I'm helping those bears. I'm helping those bears in the proper way because we're showing tough love. We're showing, hey, you don't really belong in here around us, you guys.
Right.
And we're doing that all non-lethally.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I feel like, you know, you're always going to get those people that are like, oh, poor bear and whatever. But like the people that are living in these areas like have the rights to not have all their infrastructure ruined. Also, you don't know, like, when bear comes out hungry, like, what could happen. It's just, like, doing all the things you can to make sure the coexistence actually works. Like, having the bear live under the house, that's not proper coexistence. That is something different. So, yeah, I definitely can see, like, the struggle for sure. Because, I mean, people are always so difficult when it comes to wildlife stuff. But I'm not sure if it's the people that have bears under their houses too saying, oh, why don't you just leave it? And when you're getting, yeah, a $10,000 electrical bill, maybe you won't feel that way anymore.
And that's happened. That happened a couple of years ago to somebody. They had second homeowner, doesn't live here. They got a gas bill for 1 month for $5,000. And they sent a local contractor up to go look at what was going on. And he couldn't figure it out, looked under the house, and there's, lo and behold, there's a bear. And so I got called to come in. And the bear had also broken a hot water pipe under there, so it was spewing hot water the whole time, which was doing damage in the walls and things like that. And so these situations where they're getting under the buildings like that, it's not really a dangerous situation for humans, per se.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not their food source, so that's even, you know, if when they start becoming active, and some of our black bears, urbanized black bears, stay active all winter. They may be denning in one spot, but they're going out maybe once a week, accessing some open dumpster somewhere, getting a few calories. They don't have to eat much, and they don't want to eat much.
Right.
Well, the issue, the human bear conflict issue, and the dangers involved that really come into play when we start getting these bears that are willing to break into houses.
Right.
And when I say break into houses, what breaking and entering used to be for the bears around here in years past was going up and looking for the open unlocked slider, going up looking for the open window, believe it or not, going down the street checking car doors to see if they're open.
Okay.
Right? This is all learned behavior, mom teaching cubs.
Yeah.
Well, that behavior over the last few years has started ramping up. So it used to be looking for that open, easy access source has turned into busting through dead-bolted front doors, busting through windows to go into properties. Again, no maliciousness on the part of the bear. They just realize, easy meal, house, there's going to be food in there. Sometimes I believe these bears have foregone trying to smell for food because literally sometimes they go door to door. Seen it happen. Seen them do it with cars. Just go down the street checking car doors.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
But here's where it becomes problematic, is they become so habituated to being around us humans that now these bears, when they break in there, again, before, when they were looking for the sliders and stuff, they'd stop, look, listen, and smell. And if they felt there was no humans in the house, then they'd go in. They've gone far past that. They'll walk past people. They'll walk past people in the living room to go into the house. You know, somebody's sleeping, you know, open slider. Bear comes past. I've had people let me, you know, call me and go, I was woken up out of my lounge chair by a bear walking out of the kitchen past me back to go out.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And I don't care how groovy you are as far as being bear knowledgeable. I hear that all the time. Well, these people should get more educated. It's their own fault if something bad happens. Well, if you don't know that bear's in your house, because they're very stealthy, they're like ninjas, man. Some are 400-500-pound ninjas. Mm-hmm. What they can angle up walls sometimes. I've seen it. I've seen them tear through walls. So you don't know that bear's there, or you hear something in your house, and all of a sudden you, by the time you realize it, you also realize you're standing in their path for their exit.
Right.
Because when a black bear enters a house, it doesn't know there's other exits. It knows one way in, which is going to be the same way they're going to want to go out. So usually when we have these physical altercations between a human and a black bear, that's what's happening. The number one cause of human-bear conflict, physical interactions, and this just happened, I believe, somewhere back in Ohio, somewhere back in the Midwest, is a woman was mauled by a black bear with cubs. She was with her dog.
Right.
Dogs can precipitate more black bear attacks than any other situation. And again, generally, black bears don't want to attack, but every once in a while, something happens. Now, here in the state of California, the state of Nevada, and the state of Oregon, no wild black bear has ever killed a human.
Okay.
But with this bolder and bolder behavior of putting themselves in close contact with humans without any fear, that may change.
Right. It's almost like inevitable at that point, especially if you just keep letting them get closer and closer. So, yeah.
Well, and here's one of the other parts of the issue, because I talked about, you know, our population density earlier, the 400 to 500 bears, and explained to you we have 2 to 3 bears per square mile. A natural black bear population density for the Lake Tahoe Basin, those 190,000 square acres, would be about 50 to 75 bears.
Right.
And so we have a number of these urbanized black bears that they don't leave our urbanized environment. So if there are wildland bears in a wildland environment, their foraging area would be up to about 100 square miles. That's a big foraging area, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, somewhere between 50 and 100 square miles. Our urbanized black bears rarely forage more than 4 square miles.
Right.
And within that 4 square mile area in town, there's still tons of natural black bear food sources.
Mm-hmm.
But black bears, once they learn that human food attractant thing,
mm-hmm.
because our food is far higher in calories than theirs is.
Right.
So instead of having to spend 8 hours during a regular day in the summer or up to 16 hours during the fall when they're in hyperphagia and they raise their calorie intake to prepare for overwintering, you know, they can do that in an hour or two just doing the dumpster diving.
Right.
Here in town. You know, unsecured pet food, bird feeders, fruit trees. And people go, well, apples, that's a natural food. Bears. No, apples are not a natural food for bears because they don't grow in the wild.
Right.
You know, it's okay if we put some apples out for them. And, you know, and that's the other issue is you still get some people. We educate people, but you still get people, oh, it's okay to feed them. No, it's not.
No,
it's not doing those bears any behavior. And there's actual physiological changes that are happening within these bears that are different than their wildland cousins. So, for instance, an urbanized black bear is going to weigh generally 25% more than their wildland cousin. We regularly have males that weigh upwards and above of 500 pounds here. That's
right.
Brown bear territory for a male black bear. We regularly have sows, female black bears, if you know, as they get older, getting into the 300 to 400 pound range or more.
Right.
That's unheard of. So there's one of the physiological changes. Their teeth are rotting out faster than their wildland cousins because they're accessing so much of our, you know, our food's junk. It's junk food.
Sugar,
right?
and all the crap. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's it. And that drives them. When a bear breaks into a house and goes into the refrigerator, it ain't grabbing broccoli.
No.
It's not grabbing the lettuce. It smells calorie content, and generally it wants fat. So it's usually grabbing the ice cream first or food content with a high fat content and then high sugar content. They love sugar. They know what soda cans look like. They'll bite right into them and drink them. It's, again, extremely intelligent animals.
Right.
But it creates such a dynamic and such a nuanced situation. There's no one set deal to deal with it all. And it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of years to try and mitigate this ramping up of behavior. If tomorrow we were to completely eradicate and secure all human attractants and keep bears from being able to access it, In the short term, we'd probably see a lot more break-ins. And I truly believe, because if they know that behavior and they want food, they're going to use it.
Right.
And they don't forget stuff. Actually, that may be untrue that they don't forget stuff, because this is a very interesting story. There was a black bear a couple years ago, a very large male that walked into a Safeway in Kings Beach. A month later, walked right into the 7-Eleven. You know, that's a dicey situation. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, Fish and Wildlife would probably just completely remove that animal from the environment using fatal means. Mm-hmm. But because of the outcry and it got so much press, they decided to translocate it. Translocation, relocation doesn't really work that well. The bear either comes back or dies trying to come back, or in this bear's case, completely urbanized bear. And you can only take them within their own genetic range. You can't take them 600-700 miles away. That's not a thing. It has to be because there may be certain diseases running through a population, one population of black bears that another population hasn't seen. So you just can't throw another bear into that. You have to be very careful for those things. It's not such a simple fix. So they take this bear out about 80 miles from where it lived to the southwest, out in a very rural wildland environment. They collared it. Within a month, the collar was off. So probably lost a bit of weight. Within about 4 or 5 months, a bear was seen at the side of a campsite and wouldn't leave for about 2 to 3 days. And finally, the folks camping there, the gentleman had a gun and he was getting freaked out because it kept encroaching into the campsite. And they had a lot of children at the camp and he shot it. He winged it, didn't kill it. Fish and Wildlife came out. They found the bear. They euthanized it humanely. Turns out it was that Kings Beach bear that once weighed over 500 pounds, now weighed 250 pounds because it didn't know how to forage for wild food anymore.
Right.
It had forgotten how. If it had ever really had ever done that in its life. I mean, I don't know how long it had been in that urban environment. So there's a lot of negative consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mortality. It's a super, super complicated story. So like along that lines, like we see the work that you're doing, doing these bear evictions and helping, you know, teach people how to, you know, have better like bear-proof garbages and that kind of stuff. But then what are some other organizations doing then to try to mitigate some of these issues, like on a larger scale?
Well, finally, in the last year and a half, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife have created a human-wildlife conflict working group. It's a group of wildlife biologists that are specifically dealing with that situation. So what it used to be, we had my friend Shelley Blair was the one CDFW biologist for the whole county of El Dorado. Oof. And she had a lot. She was doing deer studies and this and that. And so it was impossible for them to ever get ahead of that issue. And so they've created this program. And they've also had another program that they've been running for a couple years prior to that called the Trap, Tag, and Haze program, where they're trapping local bears in urban environments just outside of urban environments. So people have complained, they're doing it out in the forest. Yeah, they're doing it 200 yards out in the forest next to a neighborhood. I mean, come on. It's not like they're trapping bears 5 miles out in the woods and then doing all this stuff to them. But what they're doing is they trap a bear in the urban environment. They tranquilize it. They sex it. They estimate weight, they estimate age, they take hair samples, they take blood samples, they tag it, and sometimes they even radio collar it. Mm-hmm. Radio collars are expensive, and they're not really made. That technology needs to get better for bears. It's problematic. And then what they do is wakes up, and they release it right on site, and they use paintball guns, and they yell, you know, and I use a paintball gun. And that's the most lethal weapon I use is a paintball gun. And they yell and scream and try and make it feel very uncomfortable and run away. In Nevada, the biologists have their Carilion bear dogs as well, and they'll use them for that same thing. Right. They'll chase them out and put a little stress on that bear. Say, ooh, I don't want to go back there again.
Right.
So that's helping to mitigate, but it's also giving them data. So we're getting closer to know how interrelated are they, you know, because it's so much simpler to do DNA testing these days. It's incredible. So now whenever I get samples, I go, hey, you guys want a hair sample? Yes, we do. I'm like, all right, because they put it into their studies. You know, the more data we can get on this situation, the better. And how else that helps is, let's say they do have to remove a bear from the environment and use the lethal option. Well, 10, 15 years ago, when they get that complaint or what's called a depredation permit, a homeowner might ask for, and it has to be okayed. There has to be some things that prove, okay, well, this bear needs to be removed. Mm-hmm. But before, bear goes in a trap, all right, that's the bear. And they take it back and they euthanize it. Well, now with all this DNA testing, they actually know the bear they're looking for. And if they don't trap the right bear, they'll tag it, trap, and they'll release it.
Right.
Right? So they don't... That's excellent. They don't mistake using the lethal option. You know, right. I don't love the lethal option, but wildlife management sometimes, especially with these types of animals, has to have that option. If you take it away from them, it could create a lot of really crazy dynamics, because then you're going to have homeowners to start taking the whole deal into their own hands. Well, I got a shotgun. That bear did $10,000 of damage to my garage door. And it's happened in this town. I did help make that person get prosecuted. It was in 2016. Guy shot a bear walking away from it down the street because it had gotten into his trash or something like that. But it happened so many times. And, you know, everybody has a different level of what they think. You know, somebody sees a bear walking the street. I get calls. Can you come and take that bear away somewhere else? I'm like, no, I'm not taking that bear anywhere. I don't have that authority.
Right.
Right? That's all I'm doing. The Department of Fish and Wildlife that has that authority to go to that level. I can go onto people's properties and get them out from under houses or get them out from their yard and do those things. I also get an awful lot of calls of injured bears, and I go out in the field and I triage the situation, because you can't rescue every animal. Nope. And most animals don't need rescuing, even though people, it's limping. I feel bad for it. Well, if a black bear can walk, even if it's limping, it's going to eat and it's going to survive. Right? Because remember, it's an opportunistic feeder. It's generally not chasing its food.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. And I've also come across situations where two different situations. I've had bears that were paralyzed from the waist down.
Wow.
Well, there ain't no fixing adult bears.
No.
The only candidate generally for rescue and rehab is going to be cubs of the year or young yearlings. Mm-hmm. Right? Adults, it's just not a thing, because it'd be impossible to treat them. You're not going to treat an adult bear with a broken leg in an enclosure, and they've never been in an enclosure in their life. It's highly problematic. And it might kill the bear because they want to try and get out. You know, it might not, but it might. So sometimes, you know, so with adult bears, it's like they're fine. They can survive. They can eat, and they can find safety. So when I say they can eat, if they can walk, they can eat. If they can climb a tree, they can find safety.
Right.
Those, when I do a triage on an injured bear, those are the two things I make it do. And sometimes if people are watching me, I say, look, I'm going to show some tough love here. You're not going to like what you're going to see, but I need to see that they can walk, and I need to see that they can climb a tree. And if that's mm-hmm. the case, then we don't need to we don't need to do anything here. Mm-hmm. They'll heal and they'll be just fine. Right. You see it all the time. You know, that bear some years back, Petals, that was in New Jersey, that only had two legs or something like that. And then I see wildlife moving through environment, missing legs. Moving mm-hmm. through just fine, surviving right. robustly.
Yeah, they're a lot more resilient than we give them credit for sure. Wow. Well, circling back a little bit to that program that you're saying that they're like hazing these bears in the outer forest, like that's such a great program. Like, I know people are like, oh, why are you doing it in the woods? But that's the preventative stuff, because obviously the bears that are in the city in these urban environments, like you said, they've grown up that way and they can't be changed at this point. Like, you're not going to be taking bears out of the urban environment, trying to put them away. They're just going to keep coming back. So that is absolutely the best option. But what I would love to know then is a little bit with, you know, this really high bear population inside. Do you think personally that maybe there should be some culling of the bears, or do you think that, you know, the coexistence is possible? What's your outlook on that?
Yeah, you're asking an extremely nuanced question that people, and I'm going to frame my answer to this very carefully, because never killed a bear in my life, but I have advocated for certain specific bears to be removed from the environment, and there are some people that misconstrue what I say, and they call me a bear killer, that I hate the bears, and I want to kill all bears. That's not at all. Yeah. Well, do I feel that we should have culling to mitigate our population density? No, I don't that way. I believe the only time we should be using that lethal option, because let me get back to why I say that. If we can find a way to secure all our attractants from access by bears, eventually through a number of generations, that population density is going to take care of itself.
Yeah.
Because You know, they have so much food sources active, they're having as many cubs as they can have every 2 years, right? And a black bear has this physiological method that their body knows if they can have any cubs, one cub, two cub, three cubs, and if they don't have the resources to have as many cubs, their body doesn't let them. Right. They will self-abort. Some or all of the blastocysts that are being that would be implanting into their ovaries before they implant, right? Because they have what's called delayed implantation. So, again, no culling of bears to mitigate the population density, but severe human conflict bears that have just a history of it.
Yeah,
do need to be removed. I do believe and. More often than not, what sucks is it's moms with cubs.
Right.
And she's teaching, cubs of the year, and she's teaching that behavior. There were two sows that were removed and here in town with cubs that were euthanized. Prolific. And I'm talking, again, going into houses with people in them, busting through double-paned windows, which is used to be unheard of.
Right.
Now, you might have heard of that bear, world-famous bear called Hank the Tank.
I did Hank not. The Tank.
Okay, well, I'll tell you the story, and a lot of people are going to know this story because it went worldwide. Hank the Tank was the bear that busted into a house and was busting into a number of houses in the winter of 2022. And winter of 21-22, so it was February of 2022. And brutal, busting through front doors, people in the houses. It was gnarly. Police came and got it out of the house one Friday night. And as it was going away, they thought it was a male bear, so they took a picture and they posted something on social media. Hey, we got Hank the Tank out of the bear. Well, Fish and Wildlife collected some DNA samples. They asked me if I had any DNA samples for that bear because I had dealt with it about a month earlier. I said, no, I don't. I said, but it was just Friday night. It busted out of the house. Go call that homeowner and see if you can get in. Well, they did. Turns out it was a female, so really it was a Henrietta. But Hank the Tank had already taken a hold by that. There was people out there and even a local group that doesn't care for me very much. They were raising money. They were taking Hank the Tank to the bank, right? You know, because Fish and Wildlife now at this point was actually going, now we got to get this bear, and they were setting traps up, and it just it became this media blitz, and everyone was screaming for sanctuary, sanctuary of the bear, sanctuary of the bear. Sanctuary of an adult bear generally is not a thing.
No.
Just like rehab, you're not going to take an adult bear that's lived its whole life outside and not in an enclosure and enclose it. Well, Hank wouldn't even go into a trap, so it became a non-issue, and then she kind of just blended in again. Well, this last spring of 2023, found her again. They pretty much knew it was her, and she had three male cubs of the year. So they tranked her under the deck in her birthing den, they tagged her and they collared her. And then, but they let her stay. They didn't take her away because of the cubs. And so then I started documenting her. She dropped the collar in about 3 weeks. She pulled it right off. But they kind of knew where she was moving about. And then finally, so many more break-ins, they went, all right, it's time to deal with it. But they already had a plan. And they moved mountains to make this situation happen so I could send her to a sanctuary in Colorado. Just the fact that they're taking a wild animal of that species interstate is a huge issue. So Fish and Wildlife moved mountains to make that happen, to sanctuary that bear, and luckily it worked for her. So Henrietta, Hank, Henrietta is in that sanctuary in Colorado, and she's really living her best life. I'm so happy it happened, but it's not the norm.
No, well,
it is the exception to the rule.
For me too, like the amount of resources like that it took to take that one bear, like how much more, you know, securing of resources, of, you know, education and other things to help more bears could have been done for that. Like, I know a lot of us are idealists and, you know, we want all the bears to live and survive, but taking out one bear every once in a while is what saves the rest of the population. So it's something that people have to grasp, and it's hard. Like, nobody wants to kill a bear. Nobody in Fish and Wildlife is like, oh, heck yeah, today we're going to go euthanize a bear. Like, it's not fun for anybody, but it's the grand scheme of things. It doesn't always work out. And that's a feel-good story. That's awesome. But for me, it feels like a waste of resources. And you guys can at me. Go ahead. Like, but that's how I feel.
Well, as a little addendum to that story, remember I talked about that group that was raising money mm-hmm. to Sanctuary Hank the Tank? Yeah. And that's what they raised the money. We're going to send this to the sanctuary if they get it to a sanctuary.
Yeah.
Well, conveniently enough, it was a year and a half later when they actually trapped Henrietta mm-hmm. and took her there. And at that point, that same organization said, oh, well, that's a different bear. That's not Hank the Tank.
Ah.
With DNA evidence that proved it. I can tell you the whole story of how the DNA evidence proves it.
Yeah.
But so they didn't spend a dime on any of the money that they raised to give mm-hmm. to that sanctuary.
Right.
I did. I sent that sanctuary $100.
Right.
Because it almost makes me want to cry because I love that bear. I'd known that bear for years. Mm-hmm. But I also realized that it had to be removed from the environment.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's such a complicated story, and anything that's, you know, human and wildlife conflict, if you want to call it, or coexistence, or, you know, you have that really great slogan on that one shirt, on your Instagram there, like helping people live with bears, you know, there's always a lot of stories.
Mm-hmm. Helping bears live with people is what
that's
it says.
That's it. Right.
Bear Solutions, my friend that make the electric, non-lethal electric bear mats. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, and Heather, who owns that company, she has over 20 years as a wildlife biologist specializing in brown and black bears. She's one of my, when I have questions about bears, I get to go to the experts. I know them well enough and they answer my questions. It's incredible.
That's awesome. Yeah. So on an individual level then, for people that are watching this and they might live in bear country, like what are just some of the basic things that you can do to help these bears out?
Well, the number one thing you can do is secure food attractants from any wildlife,
mm-hmm.
right? And having said that, I even extend that into bird feeders. Now, I'm not completely anti-bird feeder, but I personally don't see a need for it because I believe here, again, in the Lake Tahoe Basin, Lake Tahoe Basin is a Garden of Eden for all the wildlife that live within it, right? Because we got raccoons, bobcats, coyotes, you know, mountain lions will move through, you know, beavers, porcupines. We've got an amazing array of wildlife species live here, and they don't really need our help feeding them.
Right.
I understand bird feeders, people like to see the birds. You know, to that I would say, well, then plant a number of different wildflower plants in your yard, and that'll bring them in. It'll bring, you know, the birds that are the hummingbirds and all that, they're going to do the pollinating. It'll bring them all in.
Mm-hmm.
And but not other wildlife species.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's first and foremost, securing attractants. Again, here in Lake Tahoe, you know, we live in a fairly cool environment, and so none of us have air conditioning. And some of the last couple summers were the hottest I've ever seen in 40 years. We were hitting the 90s regularly. That's rare for us to do. And so what do? We leave our windows open. We leave our sliders open. That's kind of a no-no. If you're not at home, you don't want to leave windows open and unlocked. And if you're home but not in a room, you shouldn't have those windows open and unlocked. There's little tricks I like to tell people they can do. I won't get into that now. But generally, you know, that's another thing. No food left in your car. No food or attractants left in your car. It's just like camping and backpacking. The rule of thumb with camping and backpacking is if you can eat it or wear it on your body, then it shouldn't be in your tent. It should be in your bear canister, your protected bear canister. When I say anything you wear in your body, chapstick, lotion, all those things can be attractants to a bear because they smell like certain types of food sources that they eat.
Yeah, that's something that I definitely, like when I started getting out and doing more camping and stuff that I hadn't thought about was like the deodorant. And I was like, oh crap, I left it in the tent. And yeah, we had to go back and get it and throw it in there too. But yeah, so, I mean, there's just a couple little sacrifices that these people have to make, but it's just about securing it. But it's to be able to live in this beautiful place where all these wild animals still are. And I think it's like such a privilege because so many of us that live in cities don't get to experience that. So, you know, it's annoying and it's frustrating and sure you have to take a little extra step, but I don't think it's that tough for most of us.
It really isn't. Not if you just think about it. And if you use common sense and think about it and take responsibility for your actions, But having said that, I always like to remind people it's such an uphill battle on educating people on things like this. And mm-hmm. I use the example of the EPA was created in, what, 1971? And I was 11 years old in 1972 when they had that commercial of the a Native American paddling down the Cuyahoga River, in Ohio. And it's okay. Just a mess. It's just nasty looking. And he's got a tear in his eye, this advertising campaign. And from that time on, we spent billions and billions and billions of dollars educating people not to litter and to dispose of their trash respectfully and properly. Yeah. And yet it's still a problem. Mm-hmm. These education things, even with wildlife. Yellowstone, people are still walking up to buffaloes and grizzly bears right. and walking out into the thermal water. You're like,
yeah,
how are you missing the point here? Mm-hmm. I don't quite get it, but
yeah, we have a long way to go, but I like to stay positive that we're getting there sometimes.
Yeah, no, we are.
Yeah.
I gave a talk night before last. My whole educational component's really shifting, and I'm really shifting it into high speed with giving talks, but I'm also bringing in the youth element. I mm-hmm. gave a talk last spring to all 700 students of South Tahoe Middle School. They asked me back this. I was just there in January and spoke to the new incoming sixth graders, and I'll do that every year. This is that's educational great. Component is for me is really taken off, and it's becoming more important than the actual field work I'm doing moving bears. That's not even the important stuff to me anymore. Right. The important part of me is that people are now listening to me, and so I'm parlaying that into expanding this educational component, mm-hmm. right? And
right.
and I liked since. And I don't even have a website that you can go to look at and have all the do's and don'ts because I don't want to be redundant. I always suggest to people, you want us to go to that website? It's called BearWise.org. Mm-hmm. BearWise is across the United States and Canada. It's a one-stop shop. It's got everything from free downloadable coloring pages to children to templates for county and city ordinances and HOA rules. It's incredible. Right. It's a great resource. And so right. I don't need to rewrite all that stuff. I don't need to reinvent the wheel. Other people exactly. can send that message much better than I can.
Yeah, that is like going to be linked in the show notes for sure if people are curious about like, yeah, what they can do to be a little bit more BearWise. But yeah, I mean, it's good to see that, we have people like you in the community like putting in the work. And a lot of times as ecologists and biologists, we have like, this eco depression, and it's like really easy to get caught up in the bad stuff. But I think more and more, we're seeing these great stories that youth are like interested in wildlife and they think bugs are cool and, they're trying to make a difference and they're teaching even their parents and grandparents like how to do things properly. And, we've come such a long way. I have an English student that I tutor here. And today, this is funny because just today he told me the story that when he was little, on the bus, the sign said, like, don't be poorly educated. Throw your garbage out the window of the bus because they preferred that. They didn't have a garbage bin in the bus, so they didn't want it on the floor. So it was throw it outside. So, and then he was like, I think like 5 years after that, it changed to don't be badly educated, like put it in the bin. But even just, in 5 years, this difference of littering and of coexisting, because before, yeah, everybody would just shoot the bear on sight. You have a bear on your property, shoot it. Like, that's it. And now, we're figuring out how to make it work, and it's so much, it's uphill, like, with a giant boulder. But I think we're getting there. I think we can stay positive about it.
It's and the human bear conflict issues are not specific to black bears and in the United States. I mean, right. India with sloth bears, Japan with their Asiatic black bears. I've actually been interviewed on a couple different TV news stations out of Japan, and they use some of my content because they've had so many people killed in such a short period of time already this year.
Oh, sure.
But that
okay.
is more human encroachment. That's a lot more human encroachment, and Asiatic black bears are far more aggressive than North American black bears. North American black bears are pretty cash, man.
Right. Right. They're casual. That's great. Well, this is awesome. I mean, yeah, for everybody listening, definitely go check out Chuji's Instagram because you have a bunch of like really cool content and you always explain really well what's going on. And also, as you mentioned, you have all these camera traps that trap a whole bunch of other things.
If you haven't heard about like the badgers being buddies with coyotes before, also Google that because it's a really cool coexistence relationship. And yeah, there's a bunch of really beautiful things that you have to check out. So definitely people are gonna do that.
Well, thank you so much, Kirsten. It was a great talking to you today.
Thanks. I always ask a silly question to my guests before we leave to make it fun. So it's a two-part question. Okay. I want to know if you could quote-unquote hibernate like bears, just be sleepy all winter, would you? And if you would, what food would you eat for 2 weeks straight in order to gain an insane amount of weight first?
No, I couldn't den like that because yeah. I'm too ADHD and ADD, actually bears are very active in the den. Right. Like I said, in a 24-hour period, they're awake, they're asleep, they're awake, they're asleep, they're awake, they're asleep.
Yeah.
And as far as coming out of torpor and going back into eating now, interestingly enough, when bears come out of the den from overwintering and hibernating in a state of torpor, they're not super hungry. They only eat little bits at a time. They reintroduce food back into their system very slowly. But for me, that would definitely be ice cream or some sort of baked good.
Yeah, that sounds great.
That or bean and cheese burritos, because I love bean and cheese burritos.
Oh, yeah, that's great. That's amazing. Yeah, I think it's really cool. Just like really quick before we sign off is like bears often get used as the like example for hibernation, but they're not actually true hibernators. The only things that really, really hibernate are like small rodents. And so, yeah, bears, like you said, are in this like semi-active sort of state. I will link also a blog that I did about like the difference between like torpor and hibernation and brumation.
Excellent.
Because that's like a super good like resource for people who are checking it out. Because I didn't know that until like, I mean, a decent while ago. But, you know, bears are always like the example for hibernators. But they are actually a lot more awake, and that's part of, you know, why we have to be mitigating them in these issues, for sure. So, Tuji, I had a bunch of questions that you just, like, answered as you spoke, which is amazing. but is there anything before we wrap up that you kind of would like to close off with that maybe I didn't ask you about?
You know, really all I would like to say is we all need to do our best to try and coexist with wildlife as much as we can, especially now that we're coming into an age where we're going to see lose a high percentage of wildlife species. Our biodiversity on this planet is going to take a plunge here very soon, and we need to really appreciate the wildlife and the ecosystems that we live around, and we need to do our best to make sure that we have as few losses as possible. I really think that's the most important message I can convey from my heart.
Right. Like, let's appreciate what's right in our backyard and do what we can to protect it, right? That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you so much for giving me your time. As I wrap up here, I just want to shout out to my one patron, Rob Nelson. Thank you again for supporting me. And I also want to give a quick shout out. Y'all will probably notice that my audio is like a little bit better. So Garrett, who actually did the music for the intro and the outro, he's also giving me a hand editing the episodes and helping a little bit with balancing audio. So do check out in the show notes if you need a guy to help you out. He's starting out with that, and it would be awesome for you to give him some work as well. And thank you, Garrett. You're really bringing that audio up to the next level. So yeah. And last thing, we're a little bit deeper into season 3 now. I would love a little bit of feedback from the audience. Send me a DM, email, what you're liking, if there's anything that you're not, and what you want to see more of. So thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for sticking around to the end of the episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you head to the show notes, check out the links of things I might have mentioned in the show, go follow us on social media, and yes, do at me. I'd love to hear from you, what you think, if you want to be a guest with me, if you have suggestions for future episodes, that would be great. Other than that, we do have a Patreon link as well below if you're feeling like helping support the show, and I can't wait to see you around for next episode. Thanks, bye.